At the end of the food chain, there is trash, and a whole bunch of trash. All that trash waiting to be dumped leads us to ask, can America recycle its trash if the oligarchs of trash do not want to recycle that trash?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1262nd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Nagasaki who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, we've all seen the graphic of a little fish being eaten by a bigger fish, which in turn is eaten by an even bigger fish, which in turn is eaten by an even bigger fish, and so on, until there are but one or two fish left in the ocean. If you swap that little fish in the graphic for a little garbage truck, you now have the picture of how the nation's community trash haulers became the nation's trash oligarchs. In the 1950s, America's trash was a highly decentralized industry, with tens of thousands of local trash haulers and small public and private landfills taking in the nation's trash. Today, just two corporations, Waste Management and Republic Services, control nearly half of that industry, and they do so by providing a single-stream service of hauling, recycling, and dumping the nation's trash into their landfills. This concentration in the hands of two companies gives them a lot of political power, which they use to get even more political power, which they use to get even more political power, until one day they might well be the only political power left in Washington, D.C. And though the trash oligarchs have now taken over the job of recycling America's trash, they really do not make their money by recycling trash that is recyclable. They really make their money by hauling trash to the landfills. And that means what should be recycled may not be being recycled. And so we ask, can America recycle its trash if the oligarchs of trash do not want us to recycle that trash? And who better to ask that tough question than Neil Seldman and Brenda Platt from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Welcome, both of you. Neil, welcome aboard.
Well, thank you for having us, Michael. We're looking forward to this.
Good. Brenda, good afternoon, good morning, wherever we are. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having us.
Good. Well, now that we have both of your voices on, we can tell the difference between Neil and Brenda. Well, let's start with you, Neil, and a little bit about the whole notion of independence or the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Tell us a little thumbnail about your organization there.
Sure. We were started in 1974 in the Adams-Morgan neighborhood of Washington, D.C. Our goal was to make that community of about 20 to 25,000 people self-reliant, meaning using the resources that flowed through the community, such as raw materials in the waste stream, but also organic matter, sun falling down on our rooftops, and of course the financial and worker base that any major city has. And we got started in early 74 and pretty quickly expanded to projects throughout the city. And then within the first 5 years, we started taking invitations from other cities to work in those cities. Cleveland and St. Paul and Newark, New Jersey were the first cities we worked in between the period 1974 and 1980. Since then, we have grown from our office in D.C. We now have an office in Minneapolis and one in Portland, Maine. And we continue to work on the issues we started with. Composting, urban agriculture, recycling, and of course energy. And we've added two initiatives over the years, one broadband communications and the other independent business and finance. And in the last 3 or 4 years, I'd say we've been among the leaders fighting monopolization of the U.S. economy, not only in the waste and recycling sector, but throughout the political economy. And our goal is to decentralize the political economy to reduce the economic power, which invariably turns into political power, by the large corporations that dominate just about every sector in our economy.
So true. You know, when I looked at your organization, I thought, boy, here's some kindred spirits. I'm a founding member and board member of this organization out here in California called Think Local First. And what we do is promote people spending their money locally first, because the money you spend in a local community compounds itself, whereas the money you spend at the big box store dissipates and goes away.
Well, excuse me, but it's interesting you say that, because one of the first studies we did in the mid-70s was of our local McDonald's restaurant in the middle of Adams Morgan. And we found out that for every dollar you spent at a McDonald's, 85% left the community.
Yeah, exactly.
But for every dollar you spent in your local restaurant or grocery store, that amount stayed in the community.
Well, you know, we did a demonstration of this whole concept with Think Local First. We gave away five $100 checks at one of our mixers to five local people who had to take these five $100 checks and redeem them for goods and services at a Think Local First business. And the business person that got that check had to redeem them at another Think Local First business. So we followed these five $100 checks around for 30 days. And in those 30 days, those five $100 checks generated $8,711 worth of business. That's 17 times.
Great study. Thank you for sharing that with us.
So when I hear you talking about recycling and composting, I hear the same message, or am I wrong?
I think you're right. Please, go ahead, Brenda.
Yeah, I was just going to say, absolutely. I mean, you started saying at the end of the food chain, there's a lot of trash or garbage, and when we have our local governments investing money on handling that, and if it leaves the community to go to a landfill or a trash incinerator, you're kind of throwing it away. But when you invest in local operations that can keep, let's say, just food scraps within your local community and convert that into compost, which I like to call black gold. It's a very valuable soil amendment. It has so many benefits to local communities. So you're greening space, you're enhancing local soils, you're creating local jobs. So even within just composting, regardless of the huge, garbage is a huge industry, so it's not just the food scraps, but if you're just composting and you try to do that locally, the spinoffs are tremendous. We've shown that for every 10,000 tons that a community generates, if they send that tonnage to a landfill or an incinerator, you may create one job. But when you're composting that at even a commercial-sized facility, you're creating four times the number of jobs. But when you do that in a network of smaller-scale facilities or supporting local farmers, whether they're urban or rural, then then the jobs per ton even grow from there. So really this idea of keeping it local is so central to everything we're doing.
And everything we do locally seems to compound itself and grow on itself, whereas everything we hand to somebody else to do for us seems to dissipate and go away and collect in other places, most notably Washington, D.C. But that's the story we're working on today, and it's going to be a very interesting story. We have two great people to bring it to us today, Neil and Brenda. So let's start off with the whole notion of how on earth did two companies become the nation's oligarchs of trash? Let's go back to the 1950s, and what was it like then to have our trash picked up? Who did it, and where did they take it? Neil?
Sure. Well, we usually refer to that age as the age of mom-and-pop companies, companies that had anywhere from 2 to 10 trucks that could serve a city and sometimes even a metropolitan area. Starting in the early 60s, two companies, Browning Ferrous Industries and Waste Management, Inc., had the idea of gathering capital and forming a national vertically integrated company that would buy up all these small mom and pops, thousands of them, and in effect create a monopoly which would allow them to squeeze more profits from industry and business consumers. At the same time as they were gathering their hauling monopoly, they were also obtaining monopolies in landfills, mainly because they had capital. And in 1976, the federal government passed the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which, to good effect, required that landfills become safe. There would be methane controls and leachate controls. Leachate is the chemical soup that leaks out of landfills, liquid that leaks out of landfills. Most landfills at the time were publicly owned and managed, but because the federal government provided no support for these locally owned landfills,
so they passed a bunch of laws that said you have to do everything just right.
Yep.
Or you have to go out. Essentially, you have to go out of business, right?
That is correct. They did not have the capital to stay in business. The two companies had capital, and they, in effect, took over, I believe the number now is 75% of all landfill capacity in the United States.
Take us back to the money. How did they sell this to Wall Street, this idea that we can take over all the garbage in the country and make a lot of money for our shareholders?
Brenda, did you want to answer? I didn't mean to interrupt. Oh,
okay. No, go ahead, Neil.
I'm sorry. Wall Street was their working partner because these purchases of these companies were not made with cash. They were made with stock prices. So there was a incentive to work with Wall Street to keep their stock prices high. That's why over the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s, Wall Street was warning Waste Management, Inc. and BFI that recycling was hurting their profits because it was taking money out of their landfills, which were giving them tremendous returns on investment, mainly because they had monopolies.
So the Wall Street people were saying, hey, why are you recycling this stuff when you can be putting in a dump and making more money?
Precisely. And this has been well documented. They got caught with their hands in the till in the year 1999. The case was held, I think, in 2001, where Waste Management, Inc. and Arthur Andersen, the big accounting firm, were found guilty of manipulating stock prices. They were fined about $500 or $600 million, but they were not forced to undo their empires. So they paid those heavy fines, but they continued to monopolize and squeeze money out of the public and businesses. We estimate, based on talking to independent companies in the field, that America is now paying about one-third more for its waste disposal than it would have to pay if there were no monopolies.
Wow, and it goes on and on and on. But that is the story of American industry these days, whether it's food or whether it's anything. It's just the big are getting bigger and wiping out the little. When we get back from this break, I'm going to ask the both of you, what happened to the mom-and-pop landfills, the small municipal landfills and the small municipal waste haulers? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. We're talking trash with Neil Seldman and Brenda Platt from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Right back.
now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Hey, folks, we're talking trash on the food chain, and you know there's a lot of it. Brenda, how much food waste goes into our trash every year? Do you have any idea?
Oh, my gosh, too much. It's like 33 million tons of food scraps are disposed, landfilled, mostly predominantly landfilled, but some are incinerated. And as a nation, we're probably recovering 6%.
6%?
You know, by weight of 6%, very low. You know, on yard trimmings, green waste, we're doing much better. We're recovering, you know, close to, you know, 70-75% of that in the U.S. But food scraps has not kept up. It's growing, but it's been a slower trajectory.
Wow. Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about what happened to the industry as the industry centralized and into vertically integrated businesses, who essentially became the oligarchs of trash. I mean, they run the show, do they not, Neil?
That's correct. And just to give you some numbers, back in the 60s, there were anywhere between 12 and 14,000 landfills in the United States, mostly publicly owned. Now we've got less than 2,000, and very few of them are publicly owned. The smaller ones closed. Whereas the landfills were scaled for 50 to 200 tons per day in the old days, right now we have landfills that take 3 and 4,000 tons per day. So the what we call them mega landfills, they are completely unnecessary. They're harder to manage environmentally. And oddly enough, there's no protection for local government. After 30 years, when the landfill company is responsible for environmental control, after 30 years, when those controls are aging, that's when the public is that's when the company is no longer responsible, and the responsibility falls on the cities and businesses that put the garbage in the landfill. It's a major insurance liability in the billions that cities do not account.
And another thing I think probably happened, that when they closed down a lot of the smaller municipal landfill facilities, the trash had to be hauled someplace else. And I suspect there was a cost in that long-haul trash run, was there not?
Absolutely. It's the centralization of the system. New York City is sending Philadelphia is sending their garbage all the way to southern Virginia or eastern Ohio or western Pennsylvania. And these are the costs that cities have to cover. In fact, it's happening in the recycling system as well, because once the big companies realized that they were not making money on recycling and they were making most of their profits in landfilling, they started to restrict recycling. They did it in the early 2000s by introducing single-stream recycling, which drove out of business many small dual stream, that means collecting things really separated, not mixing them in all together. And then they forced cities, after the local companies were shut down, they forced cities to send their materials long distances, anywhere from 25 to 50 miles out of town at great expense. I could give you the numbers for Washington, D.C., where Brenda and I live. We do now send about 30,000 tons of recyclables 25 miles up the road to a Waste Management Inc. facility. We're paying $122 a ton, and we're also paying $25 a ton extra for glass. And the facility is so poorly built and maintained that it can't recover glass for industrial standards. And glass is 20% of the waste stream.
So you're paying $120 a ton
plus 25 for glass.
So $145 a ton to have your trash hauled.
This is recyclables, mixed recyclables.
Okay, recyclables.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How much is Baltimore paying?
Baltimore pays the same amount. It's a little less because Baltimore is only 15 miles from the facility, 15 or 16.
Ah. So the closer you are, the better off you are. So
yes.
So by virtue of vertical integration, let's go through vertical integration one more time so people have a clear picture of what that looks like. First off, of course, you start with the trash haulers. There was a time when there were many trash haulers. Even the mafia got involved in trash hauling, did they not?
Yes. Any industry that requires a service, organized crime seems to find their way into it.
And so they were pretty big. I was just wondering when I was considering this subject, how on earth did waste management manage to get trash hauling out of the arms of the mob?
Well, they were the mob. Waste Management, Inc. is notoriously known for having investment in the early days from organized crime, mostly in Chicago, from what I read. And the solidification of the system was dealt with fisticuffs. In the early days of Waste Management, Inc., I know this from the early recyclers, they would be followed. Their accounts would be lowballed, meaning Waste Management, Inc. would go into the company where they were being in competition and give them a very low price for a couple of years and drive the company out of business. And then there was also breaking windows and breaking trucks and fisticuffs. I'm going to guess about the 1990s, they got rid of the tough guys and brought in the accountants and lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're, quote-unquote, a clean company. But their origins certainly intermingled with organized crime.
Okay. So by virtue of controlling most all of the trash haulers, two companies now haul the trash for most all of us. And
yes, but BFI has evolved into a company called Republic Services. And Waste Management, Inc. and Republic are the two largest.
Okay. So they haul the trash, and they haul it to whose facilities do they haul
their own.
Ah.
They bring it to their own facilities, and that's why they have a competitive advantage over independent haulers who have to pay whatever price Waste Management, Inc. and Republic set.
So by virtue of owning the landfill, they can charge whatever they want. So if somebody else is charging $10 to dump it at the municipal facility, Waste Management can say, well, we'll do it for $9.
They could lowball, or they could just buy out the public landfill.
And do they do that?
Yes, many jurisdictions have sold their facilities to larger corporations. It's just part of the toolkit that the larger corporations have to dominate the industry.
And Brenda, I think you made mention of what percentage that was of the trash that they're hauling. Do you remember that?
Well, what's compostable is almost half of what we typically put out at the curb every week. So, food waste is about 25% by weight of typical household trash. And when you include, yard trimmings and other compostable, it's almost half.
Okay.
And, that's exactly what, vertical integration is. They own all the phases of the process, the collection, the landfilling and buying up the composting and recycling facilities as well.
And so what led them to buy up the composting and the recycling facilities, Brenda? What was the motivation for them to do that?
Well, I think it's, they see they're going to lose market share if they don't. But, I want to go back to something that we were talking about with the mega landfills, and what Neil said is that they don't cover these. The price of landfilling does not cover their true cost, like the closure cost or the pollution if a landfill liner eventually, leaks, which they all will eventually. And this is one of the obstacles to moving towards a zero waste economy, doing more reuse, repair, recycling, composting, is that the price of disposal, the price of landfilling is too low. It makes it harder for the non-burn and bury options, alternatives to compete. And in other countries like Europe, where they require that all waste has to be processed before it's landfilled, there's what the cost to tip a load at a landfill is called a tipping fee. So it may be $60 a ton. It may be $10 a ton, which is really low. In Europe, they add $20 to $40 equivalent U.S. on top of that, which then is a levy that's assessed that can help fund alternatives. And we don't really have that in this country. There's a few states like New Jersey, Pennsylvania, a couple of jurisdictions that do that. And that's something we would like to see more of, that the cost of disposal is reflected more in its price. And,
you know,
and the marketplace is sending these better signals.
You know, I have having done this radio show for 1,262 Saturdays, I long ago came to the conclusion that I could develop three laws of the food chain. And the third law of the food chain is cheap food isn't. I've come to the belief that food is made cheap by taking the nutrients out of it and by having somebody else subsidize its true cost. So the cheap food they promise is really the expensive food that they deliver. And I'm hearing the same thing with respect to our trash.
Absolutely. We call it, and we want to end welfare for wasting.
I could add something to answer the question you brought up before, and then perhaps Brenda could add to it. But as we stated, organics is, let's say, 35-40% of the waste stream. The big companies lobby against laws, state laws, that ban yard debris from landfills, because yard debris is so easy to deal with. You just shred it and you have mulch. You could take it to compost. There are about 20 states that have these laws, and they're constantly under threat of repeal from Waste Management Inc. Lobbying. The other thing to point out is that there's a very famous story about 5 or 6 years ago. There was a plant in Wilmington, Delaware, that was taking organics for composting 300 tons per day. Groups like the World Bank in D.C. were sending stuff there, so was New York City and Philadelphia. And then the company needed capital. They went to Waste Management Inc., who gave them the capital, and Waste Management took over the facility, doubled its processing capacity, and the system broke down. It started to smell, and eventually the Delaware DNEC had to close it down. And Waste Management Inc. made no effort to improve and continue. And we believe that this is part of the strategy to constantly discourage composting, because if you look at it from the landfill side, the composting is taking away 35% of your material. And Brenda just mentioned that household, in each individual household, organics is perhaps 25%, which means that every time a household goes to a backyard composting system, such as Brenda works with, they're eliminating 25% of that household's waste forever, which makes it a very valuable practice, which is why some cities provide up to $75 per household to learn about a backyard composting, and they could use that money to buy a bin. And Brenda, who specializes in this, is working in Baltimore, D.C., and many other cities, establishing both household and community-based composting.
Well, and with respect to that, Brenda, I saw a note that caught my attention in your release about the anaerobic piling up of trash. Let's say, what happens when a head of lettuce, for example, is buried under dirt in an anaerobic or without air? How long does it take for that head of lettuce to decompose?
Well, let me just say that, what happens with rotting food like lettuce in a landfill is it does go anaerobic. And anaerobic, by the way, means without oxygen. So in a landfill, it goes anaerobic because it's starved oxygen conditions. And what that leads to is the production of a very potent greenhouse gas called methane. So in landfills, you have a lot of methane emissions, and despite claims that you can capture them, you're capturing very little. And there's lots of problems with capturing methane at landfills, which we can also talk about. But when you take that head of lettuce and you instead compost it, you're producing this soil amendment that's rich in organic matter that, when added to soil, actually sequesters carbon. So it acts as a carbon sink. So it's, when you're composting your food scraps instead of disposing of them, it's a complete win-win for stemming climate destruction and protecting the climate. So there's that. I can't answer the question of how long it lasts in a landfill. You know, varies.
I think the note I saw was 20 years. So
yeah, could be, and that you know can depend on
a lot of things.
You know,
but
where the landfills. Now there's also controlled anaerobic digestion to produce biogas, and there the biogas is completely recovered because it's a controlled environment, and we have small-scale biogas anaerobic digesters on farms and other sites. So one of the things that we are promoting is we think scale and ownership are important and having a distributed, if you will, infrastructure. So there's large-scale anaerobic digesters that want to take 200,000 tons a year. We don't think that's the first priority, but you know, promoting on-farm composting and on-farm digestion is a good way to go. And I'll just say back to this example that Neil gave on the Wilmington composting facility, that very large industrial scale facility that Waste Management owned a majority share in, that the largest controlling interest in that facility, and drove it into the ground. I mean, there was a lot of talk at the time that one of their goals to shutting that plant down was indeed to eliminate competition with its regional landfill.
Now, Brenda, you're not saying the oligarchs and trash would be getting rid of competition. Well, hold that thought. We're going to come back. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd like to talk about what you two are doing to change the world. Do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. Metro Farm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutrientsToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutrientsToGo.com. NutrientsToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Today we are talking trash with Neil Selman, who is the president for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the director of the Waste to Wealth Initiative. Also with Brenda Platt, director of the Composting for Community Project with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And I guess I look at the situation and I see that the oligarchs of trash own us. Because when you own the trash, when you control the trash, you own everybody. Because what happens if nobody picks up the trash? We're in big trouble really fast. Go ahead.
It's a good observation, and we can complement that by pointing out that these big companies are constantly lobbying the federal government. They're constantly getting appointed to these committees, and they control the policy formation network in the country. And it's a very profound barrier that we have to overcome. But it has been overcome. I can continue the story of the Delaware compost plant. When that plant shut down, I'm guessing 5 or 6 years ago, the public reacted. There was no private investment in composting. But in Howard County, Montgomery County, D.C., and Baltimore, and other counties in the megalopolis between Delaware and D.C., forced their local government to start composting programs. There are plans now in Baltimore, D.C., Howard County already built theirs for their own material. Prince George's County, another neighbor of D.C., built a larger facility so that they can take materials from surrounding jurisdictions. So the public has reacted because the composting is incredibly popular, as Brenda can explain. Each time she tries to sign up groups for training, they're oversubscribed. Mm-hmm. So there's general popularity for composting.
Well, you know, it's always been very a popular notion ever since Earth Day. I remember everybody got into composting and recycling, and that's what we did. And then someplace along the lines, the oligarchs of trash bought them all out. And so how are we going to prevent the oligarchs of trash from coming in and buying up what's now being rebuilt again?
Well, we call it relocalizing the recycling system, and that is bringing facilities back into the inner city or close into the city. It means passing laws that require minimum content, so you can't sell a newspaper in your state unless it has 40% minimum content. And there are the EPA just came out with a report last year showing over 150 local initiatives coming from the grassroots to improve the recycling system. So it's a very dynamic movement at this point. And we focus on composting because you can't make money composting if you ship it a long distance. And we feel that with market development, investment that many states like California, Michigan, and New York are undertaking, we can rebuild our domestic capacity to use these materials. In fact, since the Chinese disaster of 2018,
which was
when China refused to take our materials because they were so contaminated that they weren't industrial materials anymore. And as a result of that, the investment in U.S. recycling capacity has soared. There are more than 20 paper mills being built in the country now. The plastic industry, independent plastic processes, are investing in all kinds of ways to pelletize the plastics and use them in domestic industry in the United States. Same thing is happening with electronic scrap, which is highly valuable. So the relocalization is actually happening. We, for instance, we're doing research. I can give you one example. There's a glass plant down in North Carolina, in Wilson, North Carolina, that processes 100,000 tons of glass a year. And they sell it to a variety of industries, bottle making, insulation, ship cleaning, and they support 2,300 jobs in the United States. And you can't ship glass overseas because it's too bulky. So we're building up the industry and its capacity, and we have to constantly fight the oligarchies, yeah, as you describe them.
Well, Brenda, let me ask you this. Do you think this whole process of rebuilding our recycling and infrastructure, both for recycling compost and so on, do you think it has to be local? Because it seems to me like the oligarchs of trash are not interested in recycling because they make their money simply by dumping stuff in their landfills. So the more stuff they put in the landfills, the more money they make. And if you're recycling 30% of that, you're taking away 30% of their profit. And of course, that means they're going to go to the government and fight like hell to not have to recycle stuff. Am I wrong?
I think you're right. And there's another point I want to make about, you know, oligarchs and corporate concentration. It's not all at the back end with the trash. It's also up front. So if you think about the companies that are making a lot of this disposable plastic crap, Solo Cup, you know, the chemical companies, whether it's Dow or DuPont, you know, think about all the companies that make water and single-use, you know, plastic bottles that we don't need, you know. And so they're making a lot of money. They don't want to see that market share disappear. So it's in their interest to produce all this single-use crap so they can continue to make money. And that's another form of corporate concentration that when we move towards a zero-waste economy, we are literally getting rid of. Mm-hmm. And they fight, you know, there's cities that have passed bans on single-use plastic shopping bags, and these companies will fight those bans, you know, at the state level, preventing, you know, Ann Arbor, Michigan is a perfect example where they tried to pass a bag ban, but the state government said, oh, you don't, you know, we're going to preempt you. So preemption is a big issue, and that's why, you know, with their political power and state legislatures to fight what's good. So, you know, but instead if we're moving towards, you know, using, you know, we're blessed in this country, if you're not in Flint anyway, with, you know, good drinking water. And so for most of us, we have access to good drinking water. We can fill our bottles, and we don't need to buy those single-use plastic products. The same is true for things like diapers, by the way, where you have, like, you know, a handful of companies who make disposable diapers. And it used to be in this country we had hundreds, you know, of family-owned diaper service companies that would provide cloth diapers. You know, it's not like you had to wash them. So we could probably go through so many common products that we use and in each one identify an alternative that would generate less trash and contribute more money to our local economies and local businesses.
So all of these jobs. All of these companies that manufacture these products and sell them tend to become concentrated and vertically integrated like every other business in the country. So they want to become large enough to have the economies of scale sufficient to be able to buy the government, as have the oligarchs of trash. They own the government. And so how do you compete with them to get the government to get behind recycling?
Yeah, well, and you know, we used to say we make the rules and the rules make us, and so much of the obstacles that we face in moving towards a zero waste economy or more composting, whether it's large scale composting or community composting, that a lot of the obstacles are in the hands of government and often even local government, not even state government. So as all of us as citizens can be reaching out to our city council, our mayors, county councils, pushing for them to do better in this field. So in their contracting, they could have a law that basically says you can't contract with any bad actors. So, like, that could be a company that's been accused of price fixing, like Waste Management. So, therefore, you know, you can no longer, if you have a law that says you can't contract with any bad actors, and that could be somebody who's been convicted of a felony, like Waste Management has in certain parts of the country, then you've just eliminated them as a potential contractor in your city government. So there's a whole list of things that local government can do to help move us in the right direction here.
And we do have access to local government because we see them on the street. Hey, Mr. Mayor.
Exactly.
And that's why the biggest threat to our, if you will, clawing back the recycling and waste system is that the big soda companies, Pepsi, Coke, Nestle's, as well as other Fortune 500 companies, want to preempt all local activity in passing packaging and recycling laws.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
They want to, how does this work? They want to preempt local authorities from managing their own recycling?
That is correct. It's it's already happened in California. Pepsi-Cola threatened the state with a big effort to change the tax laws if the governor and the legislature didn't preempt all local activity from passing new packaging laws. But that's only in one state. It's happening in several states. But at the federal level, it's called extended producer responsibility, which is a good concept, a polluter pays concept, and it works very well for hard-to-recycle materials, such as batteries and hazardous material. However, what the EPR people want to do is take over all recycling, get rid of local government's activity in the area, and basically disenfranchise local organized citizens and small businesses.
So it really is a situation in which the oligarchs of trash are becoming one of the sole powers left then.
Yes, this is the end game. Extended producer responsibility over recycling traditional materials is the end game of the corporate effort to bottle recycling. Since they got control of the landfills and the hauling contracts, they have started gobbling up all the recycling processing centers called MRFs, Material Recovery Facilities. The two companies, Waste Management, Inc. and Republic, own at least 50% of all the processing capacity in the United States. And there's an epical story in St. Paul, Minneapolis, where a local company, Eureka Recycling, grassroots community-based company, saw the handwriting on the wall that they were going to get squeezed out because the county was going to get out of processing. They're selling their stuff to Waste Management, Inc. So they went to the people that were buying their clean materials and raised money to build their own MRF. And because they controlled their own destiny, they got the recycling and processing contracts for those two cities, St. Paul and Minneapolis. And that is what clawing back is all alike. People in Baltimore are trying to implement the same type of system, because it allows the materials and the jobs to stay in the city, and it allows the city economy to add value to the materials by baling them, by composting them. You add value, and ultimately, cities are now Austin, Alachua County, Florida, California, there are 40 of them, industrial parks just for recycling companies. So as I said, with all the obstacles we're facing, the enthusiasm on the grassroots, including local government, is very, very high, and we are having victories, daily victories, in clawing back the system to local government and organized citizens.
So it really is all about local.
Yes, local. But local groups aligned with other local groups. That's how recycling got started. Information sharing going back to the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It's a literal committee of correspondence, as we had in the original American Revolution. Citizens sharing strategic information together.
So, do you think that the oligarchs of tech are going to shut down that information flow?
I think we're going to win. I think democracy will win in the long term, and I think people are very sensitive to democracy now, and the threat to take away their vote on how garbage or recycling should be handled in their very own community, I think people will rebel about that. And Brenda and I and a whole network of people, Zero Waste Associates, Greenpeace, Gaia, Global Anti-Incineration Network, there's a national, and we're hooked up with the European and Asian recyclers as well. This is a worldwide movement to stop trash. We're focused on plastic for obvious reasons, but the movement entails a complete reform of the way we deal with our waste materials.
Well, Brenda, you know, after Earth Day, everybody became extremely conscious about recycling and composting and whatnot. But then when the, you know, when the Goliaths and the oligarchs of trash took over, we kind of lost interest because, well, out of sight, out of mind. Do you think we can get re-enthused to the extent that we can stand up to these oligarchs?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite hopeful. And I'll just say that, you know, environmental justice issues have very often been tied to trash issues. Because where are the landfills built? Where are the trash incinerators built? They're built in areas of least political resistance.
Yeah.
The trash incinerators are almost always in communities of color and under-resourced and overlooked communities.
And on and on and on it goes. We just ran out of time. But I want to tell people to be sure and tune in to the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Learn about composting your food waste. Learn about recycling your trash. Let's take control of our lives back from the oligarchs of trash. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.